Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, capital budgeting. The topic of this lecture is one of those main things that finance does in a corporate environment. And whether or not you are a finance major, you find out that this one thing is kind of dominant in some aspects of a corporation's life. And there are a lot of important stories behind it. And I will share some of that with you. As a matter of fact, one part of this, I just got a this weekend, I saw another example of something I'm going to talk about here in just a little bit. But before then, just a quick look at the numbers. The typical pattern, this is a bull day. The Dow is up maybe a quarter of a percent. Slow, quiet, low-risk companies. The S&P 500, big, somewhat more aggressive, competitive companies, up more. Up about two-thirds of a percent. And then the NASDAQ, the high-risk companies, up a rather appalling 1.75%. This is definitely a good day on the street, which, of course, kind of goes against the doomsayers who keep saying the end is near and all that. Well, the equities, investors are pouring money into the equities. Crude oil, there you go. It's above 100, and it's moving its way upward through the day. It's fighting its way back above the $100 mark, trying to find. It's going to be a while before it gets to that 125 mark, but it'll find its way there. What we are seeing now is that when the announcement that a million barrels of oil would be released from the Strategic Reserve of the United States, well, that said, well, supply goes up, price goes down, big time. And then there was generally some belief that Russia was going to be able to sell some of its oil and all that kind of stuff. Everything was going to calm down. This weekend was a wake-up call with the evidence that is coming out of Ukraine of the insanity of what the Russians are doing there. The civilized world, and I refer to anything that is not Russia, the civilized world is basically saying, nah, we're not going to cut any slack. This is going to go full bore. We're going to shut that country down until it strangles. I mean, there is just, from what I am hearing and what I'm reading, there is just absolute disgust and fury. And there's going to be no oil. Nothing is going to come out of that country. So that means restricted supply of oil. So there you go. We're going to have oil prices going up. Again, though, that's not all bad, because as the price of crude oil goes up, that makes it more economically feasible to get us off our butts and moving toward alternatives to hydrocarbon products and internal combustion engines. That is going to be a rough road ahead, as we are now finding out. A minor story on the side has to do with California. California did a virtue legislation where now all machinery, industrial, farm equipment, you name it, must be no longer using gasoline, oil, anything that's hydrocarbon. It'll all go to biodiesel. Biodiesel is soybeans. Now, if you make every machine, farm, industrial, commercial, machine biodiesel using in California, that will use up about every bean of the soybeans in the world. All of it. Okay, that's not good. California thinks that it is more important than the rest of the planet. That is bad, not just for a number of reasons. Oh, wait, the two of the large producers of soybeans are Ukraine and Russia. Oh, supply is going to be disrupted. Oh, another thing too, soybean is the base of the high-calorie foods that are what the poor people of the world in Asia use to keep themselves alive past the age of 30. So we're going to take away their food just for the virtue of our green energy. There's always a consequence, and the law of unintended consequences seems to be playing out pretty darn badly here. We'll all be switching over to oils like canola, which is much more unhealthy than soybean oil. So there's that too. So always keep an eye on what the downside is of what sounds like a great way. Yeah, we'll get rid of our crude oil dependency. Let's go to biodiesel. Oh, that's going to really help the food supply of the world, doing something like that. Food for cars and tractors and industrial machines, but not for people. Okay, good news. Bond prices. The yields are going up, so the prices are going down. That means that investors are selling bonds safer, and they are moving that over here to equities, riskier. Reverse flight to quality. That is more evidence of some degree of bullishness in the market right now. On the other hand, let's look at that yield curve. It's got only one day for April, but as you can see, it is the inversion is now fully 3, 5, 7, 10 year. It is a really severe inversion on the 7-10 year leg. That's a 12 basis point inversion. That is a recession 9 to 12 months down the road. On the other hand, I have been, my forecast was for a moderate recession. There is an awful lot of strength in this economy. Jobs picture is really strong. We're getting to the point of the lowest jobless rate and the fastest job formation we've seen in years. And we got a lot of industrial production needed. If we are moving away from crude oil, that means that we're going to have to get our butts cracking on the alternatives and industries that manufacture and support that. We got a lot of potential ahead of us that could blunt any recession that comes. It doesn't look like it's going to be more than a light to moderate recession at this point, but still a recession. So there's that going into the election season, as it were. So good news ahead for the ruling party whenever something like that happens. Okay, enough of all this. I'm going to start with a story here. It's kind of a generalized story, but it has importance now. This topic, capital budgeting, it's a fancy way of saying go or no go on projects. Do we decide to take a project or do we decide not to take a project? It actually boils down to a yes or no. That frustrates the heck out of people in marketing. They've got an ad campaign and the finance people say no. Why? It's just no. Or a new piece of machinery, no. Why? Because this number came out to be this. And it boils down to that number. Now, the decision-making process for centuries was ridiculously simple and it was incorrect. However, it did get us to where we are now. And in our time, you folks have to be a lot more technical than back in the old days. I mean, even when I was first a consultant, a lot of the yes or no to an idea for a new project, a product, whatever, was like seat of the pants. It was just a gut feeling the business people had. Yeah, I think this will work. I see a market for this, or this might be the next wave, so let's go with it. It was like an informal thing that was driven by a gut sense that business people had of whether or not something should be tried. Well, unfortunately, I started my consulting career in that mode where every company that I talked to was like that. They all had that same kind of mentality. It's all in what your genius is. Unfortunately, we're not in that time anymore. We have to be really technically accurate, scientific, use equations from physics, use the mathematics that we can generate from our calculators, from Excel spreadsheets, from computers. We can't do it the old way. Well, yeah, we can. Well, no, you can't, because your competitors are going to do it the right way. If you decide, well, I want to build a car and I think that piston should be about like that, and there's a mathematics that is used by your competitors to get exactly the precision for the highest performance, yeah, they're going to win because they use the technical means that we don't. And that's why we always worry about countries where their mathematical skills are much higher than ours. I've mentioned this before. Maybe I haven't told you this. The funny thing was that when I was in the PhD program at Ohio State, you had this maybe about 40 students. Half of them were from Asia and half of them were from the United States or a European country. That first year, the mathematics, they were just killing us. I mean, I was a math, unfortunately, I was the slight autism and all that kind of stuff, said, oh, yeah, math is easy for me. But for most of them, that first year, most of the American students were wiped out. It was only in the second year that when everyone had to use that math to make real-world decisions and make real-world calculations, that's when we came through. We said, oh, we do it. We've got the math. We can do it and make decisions from that math. And so the second year was a much better year for my grades. But that's where we are now. We have competitors in the world who are great at the math. They can just, in their heads, they can do it. How do you do that? And we are struggling with that now. But then if we can get past that, know the math, know how to do it, then we can let our power, our comparative advantage, our genius begin to play through. So what I'm showing you here is the math. Then comes the next step. And unfortunately, your textbook doesn't talk about that next step too much, but I got to get through this first. Look, there was a wrong method that was used for many years for yes or no. It was, I've seen documents from business people in the Renaissance, and I'm pretty sure they were talking about this method in their decisions on whether to do new products, explorations, and all of that. Now, one would think and now we have two technically correct methods to do it. They are supported by theory. They're supported by evidence in the field. They're the way we should do it. So, and I'm going to just write them quickly, and then I'll go back through them. This old method was called the payback period method. Then there are two new technically accurate methods, NPV and IRR. Actually, NPV is much stronger than IRR. They're both technically correct, but IRR can fall down sometimes. It has a place where you can't use it. Now, when I started first consulting, everyone was using payback period. Even though NPV and IRR had already shown up in academia at that time, they'd been around for years before. Every business person I knew, I crossed, was still using payback period. It's easy. It seems to be right. It's logical, I mean, in its own way. And so, you get now a study done about, 5 years ago, I suppose, was asking the decision makers in large companies. It was a vast survey of a bunch of things. And they were saying, okay, which one of these methods are you using? P- payback period, NPV, IRR. Surprisingly, about 45% of the companies are still using payback period. Surprisingly, payback period is still around. Even though it's technically wrong, it leads to wrong decisions so much, but what the heck? So even now, this old, tired, worn out, invalid method is still popular. 45% of companies are using it. Interestingly enough, those who are not using it, most of them are using the somewhat weaker of the two correct methods. They're using the IRR method. You might even see kind of why. But okay, this weekend, I was at a luncheon on Saturday with the some of the people in the finance, they call it the treasury, of a fairly large company around in this area. And they were talking about decision making, how they make the decisions, and the head was laughing about these two MBA graduates who didn't think that the payback period method was what they should be using. He said, I mean, you know, everyone knows that's how you do it. And I, wait a minute, you got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and you don't know that that's wrong? Oh, I didn't say that. I mean, they were paying for lunch, so I wasn't going to say anything, for God's sake. But I mean, it was just jaw-dropping. These are educated people, and they're laughing at the people who are coming out of the best schools. We're a top-ranked school, for God's sake. And they're laughing at what we're teaching. So here's the upshot of it. No, you are not going to go into a company and say your first meeting where they're doing this decision making, well, you shouldn't be using the payback period method. Don't do that, for God's sake. Just roll with it. The point of what we do here is that we're sending out a wave that will grow through time. As you become stronger, higher up in companies, you become the influencers, then the decision makers. You'll carry the right methods with you, and then you will be able to do this down the road, 10, 15, 20 years. It won't happen immediately. Even though we're pushing this out, we get you to know how to do it. We get you to understand why you do it. It'll still take decades before it will become embraced and will be embedded. So that maybe in 20 years, instead of 45% of companies using payback period method, we might have only 44% using it, or something like that. This is that problem we have in any society, is hold on to tradition too long and at your own peril. At the same time, if you just grab whatever fad is out there right at the start, that's even probably more perilous. So always find your place between those and wait your turn to begin to tell the world what the right ways to do things are. All I can do is start the wave moving, and then you have to carry it forward with you. Hell, we talk about things back in the 60s when we thought we would solve every civil rights issue, and here we are today still battling it out. But, you know, we do it. We do what we can. I'm going to show you the payback period method. Partly so you know what it is, but also partly so that I can show you, it's almost obvious what the two big problems are with it. But here it is. Let's take a year and the free cash flow. In other words, profit. Okay. So in year zero, you're going to push out an investment of $25,000. So it's a negative $25,000. Now, in year one, the project picks up a little bit of business, $5,000. In year two, you're beginning to cook along, let's say, $15,000. Year three, you're going at $18,000. Year four, it's beginning to tail off a little bit to $10,000, and in year five, That's the end of the project. You got $3,000. Okay. I'll talk more about these numbers in a little bit. But here's how payback period works. A company sets a payback period policy. Let's say that theirs is, payback period is less than or equal to 3 years. In other words, it's a no if the project does not pay for itself within 3 years. So if we look at this project, year one, there's 5,000. By year two, you've got the 5,000 and the 15, so you're at 20,000. Year three, you've got the 20,000 and 18, so you're at 38,000. Year four, you're at 48,000, and the project finishes up at 51,000. So as you can see, the project has paid for itself before year three, so it's a go. That's all there is to the payback period. You see how simple it is, how easy it is, how alluring it is. It's deceptively easy. And why those executives were laughing at those young MBAs who wanted to use a complicated thing for something that's so simple to do. Okay, here's the first flaw. These numbers, 5,000, 15, 18, 10, 3, they are not in the same denomination as the 25,000 out. They didn't take into account the decay of money, the time value of money. $5,000 1 year from now is not comparable to money that you have now. $15,000, discount that back 2 years at some discount rate. That's definitely going to be not $15,000. It's going to be something less than $15,000, maybe $12,000. By the time you get to year three, the discount of $18,000 3 years back, so you can compare it to the negative $25,000, I mean, that's not $18,000. The present value of $18,000 3 years away at any decent discount rate is going to be something like maybe $12,000, $13,000. So in other words, the payback period method does not take into account the time value of money, the discount that occurs on money in the future compared to money now. So that's its biggest technical flaw. Okay, well, fine. Then just take the present values of these and do it. There's still a much more fundamental flaw. That right there, the 3 years. Where is that coming from? I asked companies back in the day, and I wanted to ask these people at that lunch on Saturday, where do you get this number? Where is this coming from? The response I've always gotten is, well, that's what we use. That's our number. It's ours. A completely useless justification. So every project has to pay back in 3 years. Well, within 3 years. Well, yeah, that's how we do it. Lol. You see, it's completely arbitrary. There's your problem. It's arbitrary. It's not scientifically determined. It's not determined by some method. It's just there. And oftentimes, back in when I was doing original consulting, they don't even remember when that was set in the past. Well, we've just done it that way. That's how we do it. That's the number. That's how many years for our payback period. Always done it that way, always will do it that way. Okay, there's the biggest flaw of all, is that you don't want any decision to be arbitrary, to be without a justification. If I'm going to cover my ass, I'm going to cover my ass with every equation I can find instead of just saying, well, that's just what we do. So there's its largest flaw right there. Is this how it was done? Sure. And did businesses succeed? Sure. A lot of businesses, more businesses fail, but for a lot of reasons. But we need to tighten this up and make it a mathematics of the universe, physical laws of nature applied to finance, applied to the decision-making process. then we have a better chance of having what we do in sync with what nature wants to have done. So there you are on that. Now, before I go on to the other two methods, and we should thank heaven, these calculators are awesome. Back at, I'll give you a little sense of that here. But back in the day, I mean, we did these on slide rules, on paper and pencil. When we had a chance, we got over and got slack time on the supercomputer at Ohio State to do these calculations. Now you just push some numbers into a stupid calculator, and there's your Uncle Bob. But be happy for the time in which you live, my good people. But let me talk about something else that's going on here. And this is important. You see that year five, that 3,000, there's two things going on here. The first is there is not a project that lasts forever. Don't have an undefined end. Get that down at the beginning. We are going to take this to this point, and then we are going to stop. Maybe if things are going a lot differently from what we thought, we can extend, but don't leave the end of the project hanging. Give it a time when you're done with it. And if you don't know that, then you haven't done enough research. You'll see in the last chapter that I cover, I do a couple of actual real-world cases. One company, you probably will recognize the companies that are involved in this. But what was I going to say? In one case, they had a hell of a good project. It was a real moneymaker. They had a time horizon. This project will end in 4 years. That's it. No more. They recognized that they don't want this thing to be some zombie that they just keep trying to get more out of, throw more money in to get a few more years out of it. They said at the beginning, we stop here. And by golly, they did stop there. They were aware of all technologies are transitional. Everything from stone axes on through to the latest computers, everything is transitional. They had a transitional technology they were using for a kind of router for the Internet of Things. And you'll see, I'll show you the case. It's kind of interesting. But they knew, okay, 4 years and this will be obsolete. So they laid it out, end of the project. So when you begin the project, you should know this is the end at year 4, 6, 10, whatever. That's it, no more. And you can have a discussion of that with the other company personnel, but everyone who's discussing it should have some basis in analytics. Why do you think it's going to last this long? Why do you think it's going to last this long? Those are decisions before you even start pushing numbers and hitting calculators. Okay, now there's a bigger thing going on here too. See that number there at the end, 3,000? That's actually not as simple as it looks because the book brings this up, but it doesn't really give you too many problems with it. At the end of a project is something called salvage value. It can be a positive or a negative. Now, I'm going to tell you a secret. I don't know who I should tell this to. Okay, I'm going to tell it to you. Don't tell anyone about this, okay? It's been 6 or 7 years ago, and I've still got my files. There was a thing going on here. We were trying to promote the College of Business, so we wanted to get a photograph of each and every member of the faculty, the staff, and all that, the deans, just a nice profile picture so that we could do some kind of thing. I don't know what it was they were going to do, but here's all our shining, pretty faces. And they knew that I was a professional photographer, and I had spent some years with portrait and some photography like that. So they said, can you do this? And I said, well, yeah, sure. I'll just need a studio so I can get up the backdrop and the softbox lights and the triggers and all that kind of stuff and get this thing underway. And I said, I don't know where I was thinking of a room like this, but it would be still be kind of a little bit tight in there. And I was thinking about shooting this way. And they said, oh, we got a huge room that's empty. You have a, really? Yeah, it's that room down in the basement. You know, have you ever been down there to that cafe there by the atrium? There's this door back there. It's like a steel door. It's locked. And that is the room they were talking about. Now, I'd always thought that was a storage room where they kept dead students and, you know, things like that. I didn't know what was back there. And so they took me back there so I could see the layout. And, you know, the door, like that, and I was expecting to have cobwebs fall down. The door, it came open, and it was an open room about the size of this flat, this auditorium flat. And they said, "This here it is." And I was looking around. It wasn't empty exactly. All along the walls was stuff. And I'm talking about old computers and electronics. And I'm talking old. I mean, these monitors. Have any of you ever seen those ginormous old monitors? You lift them up like this, boom, like that. It was those kind of monitors. I mean, they had ones that at the time would have been huge, 14-inch monitors. I mean, hell, our smartphones have bigger monitors than those do. They had all these old computers. Now, before there were flash drives, you probably have seen the diskettes that you used to stick in. And then before that, there were floppies that were these 5 1/4-inch. Most people don't know that before those, there were 8-inch floppies that you did like that. They were all over the place, those kinds of computers, boxes of old floppy disks. There were boxes full of those old kinds of modems, dial-up modems, you know, the ones that you dialed in and it dialed on your phone. Bing-ong, bing-ong, kong, and then you were connected, that kind of modems. And old telephone systems with curly wires that had been stretched all out, and all this, all over the place down there. They had, whenever they upgraded, they were just taking the stuff and putting it down there. This is actually not that unusual with companies. You see, you can sell your equipment. That's salvage value. Well, we just didn't. Well, there's an opportunity cost. It doesn't matter whether you did what you were supposed to or not. It's still a cost. You gave up a cost. You gave up something. So you have to include in your termination, shutdown, the closeout, the sale of the equipment that was used in it. Well, we're just going to use it in another project. Okay, then that other project is going to buy it, whether they use money or not. It's an opportunity cost. You need to account for it as part of your salvage value. So in other words, that increases. There's a salvage value that's positive. But then there's a salvage value that can be ungodly negative too. It is one of the most important that most companies don't pay attention to until suddenly at the end they say, oh, that. It's called environmental remediation, cleaning up the mess that you have made by production. It can be toxic waste. It can be hazardous waste. It can be closeout. It is there, and it is very real. Back in the day, companies ignored it. And now, I guarantee you that if you don't remediate, the state EPA and the federal EPA and probably some other agencies are going to come in and kick your ass with fines until you clean it up. You should be prepared for that at the beginning. Do the projections. Do the blueprints so that when the project finishes, those who are there at that time can open up those plans. And well, obviously, they'll probably have to update costs and all of that. But it is there. The roadmap to the end is fully laid out at the beginning. If you don't do that, you're going to not include incredible costs sometimes. Out there on the, if you've ever driven around these towns, the Twin Cities, out on GE Road is a giant abandoned factory. They just shut it off. They just close it off. Lol, we'll just walk away. That is an asbestos and probably other hazardous waste nightmare waiting for someone to clean it up. Well, we'll just sell the building. Well, they're going to say, no, you're not selling us those liabilities. And if you are, we're going to cut the price of this down way down because someone's going to have to clean this up. Whether we demolish it or repurpose that, it cannot be left the way it is. So in other words, there's a negative salvage value from hell in the remediation of a building. Did you know that computers are actually a hazardous waste too? Wiring, electronics. You have to include that as part of your cost of shutdown. Salvage value negative on those. Give you another part of negative salvage value. This one goes back. I was many, many years ago, I was a private pilot. You flew these little private planes like the Cessnas, those are the ones with the wings over, or maybe a Piper, the wing, or a Beech, or a Mooney with the wings underneath. They were fun planes. You bought a cheapo version and you flew it around, fun times. Well, when these companies went on and they stopped production of these old models and went to fancier models with newer materials and all of that and new kinds of engines, they just left those. Well, we've closed off that project. Let's go on. And then in the 1990s, those old planes started to kill people. The wings would fall off. That's really depressing. When you're flying a plane, when you see the wing leave, that's not good. And things like that, really. So they would, and then there were the landing gear would get old and crack on landing, and then you're skidding down the runway with sparks flying in your gas tank back there, and windshield breaking, and it was a liability nightmare. People were suing these companies back to the Stone Age. It drove some of these companies into bankruptcy because they had not planned for the liability exposure tail. They could have bought an insurance policy that would indemnify at least part of any tail of liability. But no, they didn't do that. They just moved on and pretended like there wasn't anything else that they needed to worry about. Just shut down the project and move on to something else. In our time, your time, my time now, we have to say what is past the end. What survives the closing of the project? What survives the sale of the building? We have to ask those questions now so that when we plan, we have got that covered. We've gotten it all in there. How much we'll make off shutdown, how much it'll cost us for shutdown, so that last year, you will see me in a problem, say, the cash flow in the last year from the project is $3,000. The salvage value also is this. So you add that salvage value in there at the year five or at the end year so that you get the real picture of the company, of what the project is going to be as far as a go or a no-go. You might be surprised at how many projects are a go until you look at the costs of shutdown. Realistically, with the blinders off. There's so much excitement about getting a project underway, and the ideas people are going to be very reluctant to listen to anything negative about their project. 10 years from now, why are we talking about that? Because that is our responsibility now as the stewards of the company now, is to give the future a chance. Instead of leaving it to them to deal with the problems, as we do in our society too often. Yeah, we'll leave it to the kids to handle that insane national debt. We'll leave it to the kids to handle the problems with civil rights. We'll leave it to the kids to handle the environmental mess. Instead, let's plan now so that when we get to that point down the road, when we get to the end of the line, they have a fighting chance. So in other words, you're going to see me lay in salvage values, put them in year five. Sometimes it's a net positive. Sometimes it's a net negative. But get it in there so that you don't have to sweat it out at the end. Now, there are two different appropriate methods. the net present value method and the internal rate of return method, NPV and IRR. They're both scientifically, mathematically valid. The NPV method is a stronger method. And for one reason, because the internal rate of return method actually kind of comes apart under certain circumstances. Interestingly, though, in that survey that I was telling you about, payback period, NPV, IRR, payback period was by the plurality, the most preferred. The next was, interestingly enough, the IRR method, even though it is weaker in certain situations. The NPV method is the one that is rock solid, but it's the one that would take the most calculation on the side, a sidebar calculation, to figure out what discount rate to use. You see, the NPV method, you have to get a discount rate. By, remember those, usually they use the weighted average cost of capital, which is not always the best, but you need a discount rate. The IRR actually tells you a discount rate, and then there's a problem there, but we'll talk about that. But let me lay out another problem for you. Here's a year, here's an NPV. Year zero, let's say there's $25,000 out. Year one, $5,000 in. Year two, let's do $10,000. And year three, let's do $12,000. And year four, let's do, maybe $5,000. And year five, there is $3,000, and that includes salvage values in it. Now, by the way, your textbook does talk about salvage value, but you'll find that the homework almost completely ignores salvage value, which is unfortunate because considering how much you've heard me griping about for the last 10 minutes, it's kind of important, but that's neither here nor there. Now, here's the NPV method. It's actually just a calculator routine. Let's say that the company is going to use a weighted average cost of capital of, let me do 5%. The company's overall weight of debt times the cost of debt plus after-tax cost of debt plus weight of equity times the cost of equity, you know, that whole thing. That's where why people don't much care for this method is because you have to calculate a discount rate. But anyway, now you're going to see that I'm using the appropriate use of NPV on your calculator. Now, if you want to pull out your calculator, go ahead. And I'll do some more of this on, I'll do more of this on Wednesday. But okay, here we go. Apps, finance. Now you go down here to the NPV. Enter. Okay, now, the first thing you're going to do is put in your discount rate. In our case, we're going to use the weighted average cost of capital, key in a 5. Now, the comma, this is where you put in the initial negative cash flow. In this case, negative $25,000. Now, put in your comma. Now, I notice on the quiz, some of you are forgetting that comma and they're getting an error. Don't forget, you always use a comma to say, I'm done with this. Now, second brace, now you just put in your free cash flows. In this case, 5,000, comma, 10,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 5,000, comma, 3,000. Now you close the brace. I'm done with the free cash flows. And then close the app with a parenthesis. Enter. Now if this number is positive, we accept the project. If it's negative, you reject the project. It's a positive $5,662, accept. It wouldn't matter if it was $2. If it's positive, yes. If it's negative, no. It boils down to a yes or no based on positive or negative of that NPV. That's all there is to it. Now, what if someone said, now, wait a minute. You're using our company's overall weighted average cost of capital. This project is a heck of a lot riskier than our typical project. You should be using a much higher discount rate, maybe a 12% for this one based upon the betas and CAPM for similar companies that do this project. Oh, God, do I have to put all this back in? No, you don't. Look, if you just say second enter, you go into edit on the formula that you just put in. Now we're going to go back up here and we're going to replace that 5%. Now it overwrites, but the next one you're going to have to put in a second insert to scoot everything over to put in the 12. Okay? But don't rekey something in if you got it right the first time. Now let's do this again. Ooh, boy, that took the trim off this. Well, what happened if we had put in 14%? Uh-oh, negative. So in other words, there is some discount rate that makes the project go from positive to negative. You see that? I know that at 12% it's still positive, but I know that at 14% it's negative. So there is some discount rate between 12 and 14 that's like the break point. We have a name for that. That break point is called the internal rate of return. It's the one where it goes from positive to negative. So there's where these two methods, they're in a lot of ways, you see that they're almost like the same. The NPV is finding the entire profile of the net present value structure. The IRR is telling you a very important point on that structure. Now I'm going to do these, essentially on Wednesday, I'm just going to hammer these over and over again and show you the real world use of these. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.